pieces of paper and put it on my grandmother's red and white checkerboard kitchen table to learn.
Oh, yeah? That's
I love great. Chess that much.
We have, right now, actually the honor on Monday of meeting Magnus Carlsen, who's the number one chess player in the world, and he's the youngest number one ever. He's only 21 years old from Norway, and he's only 4 points behind Garry Kasparov's record for the highest rating in history. So that's been, I guess, the highlight of my summer.
I had no idea. Are you a duffer? Do you have a rating? How are you doing in chess?
I'm what you'd call a weak expert. I'm like about a 1700 level player. I mean, I've scored some couple wins against masters, but I'm just in the process of getting some tournament experience under my belt. So I've scored some good wins and had some informative losses, but there's so much work you have to do. You know, it's not just, you can't just play by instinct nowadays. You really need to know the lines and the variations. So, you know, it's tough, just like anything else, you know. You go out on the basketball court and put on a couple slick moves with your buddies, but when you get in there in the realm of really competitive players, it's another story, you know.
Oh, I did not know that. I knew that you were a genius, but I'm so thrilled to know that, you know, I like the puzzles, and I can make my way competently to the mid-game, and I know the theory of the end, but I'm nowhere near that good.
You know, it's a good website to check out that might interest you, which is 2700chess.com.
Well, that's a perfect segue from 2600 to 2700.
Yeah, right. I didn't think about it now, but I hadn't thought of that before. But 2700chess.com tracks all the games of all the super GMs in the world. You know, 2500.
Grandmasters.
Grandmaster title. And 2700 is this very elite category. It fluctuates from about the top 40 to top 45 players in the world who have 2,700 ratings. And there's only two players in the whole world with 2,800 ratings, Carlsen being one and Levon Aronian from Armenia, number two. Very exciting chess being played nowadays.
Tell us, we're a minute away from being out of here. What are you up to?
Oh, you know, I'm trying to put this WBAI concert together. It's going to happen. Living Color has signed on. We don't have a date yet. But, you know, I want to start organizing concerts for BAI, and ultimately I want it to be an annual festival where a lot of BAI listeners can support the station in another way, but also, you know, meet other BAI listeners on the ground in a festival environment. So,
well, how can people be in touch? And I want to be part of that. Huh?
Absolutely. Earthdriver.org. There's a contact there. Please grab our free Zizek lecture. I interviewed Ornette Coleman. There's free music. There's all kinds of stuff. So keep in touch with us at earthdriver.org. We're like the music industry's answer to the food co-op.
You're
about clear.
Oh, yes, I do. Very much so. Your brilliance is the answer to the darkness that surrounds us at the
and
time
too,
of 5
brother.
O'clock
I'm,
shadow.
Oh, yeah, I was listening to you at 5 o'clock as well. I'm really proud of what you're doing over there, so I can't wait to see you soon, and definitely that concert is going to happen.
Okay, you must come in one night. See you soon.
I'll see you soon, brother. See you.
Bye. To 99.5, keep this license frequency to...
I think it's one of the four signs of the apocalypse that during Earth Watch, we're promoting bubblegum. The song's great. I just can't ever hear the song without ever think of Doublemint. Aye.
Let's hang on to what we got.
Earthwatch with Robert Knight was brought to you live with portions on recording. This is WB. I knew I wasn't going to get away with that. I knew it.
Well, that was a most Orwellian comment.
Wasn't
and
it?
I think if it reminds you of Doublemint, you need to be engaged in doublethink.
And aren't we all here in the great media? You know, because that's just what it is. I'm trying to remember why somebody, there's something about Orwell.
And by the way, that was Manhattan Transfer, and that was not bubblegum music.
No, I'm not. No, it wasn't bubblegum music, but the song. The song was used as a jingle for Doublemint.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was the gag.
Oh, my God.
It really was not bubblegum, because Doublemint isn't bubblegum.
Oh, no, that's certs, right? Two mints and one.
Why is it that the worst commercials in the world are always for mints, by the way? Whether they're, you know, the idiots getting into cars, you know, and acting like total jerks.
It's because they meant to do that. Good night, everybody. I'll be here all week.
Yes, this and other great conversation stoppers can be yours if you call and order right now. Remember that during premium time. L'esprit d'escalier, I should have said certainement. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. On recording from the Nebula Awards weekend comes she who was appointed as the Grandmaster this year, and a Grandmaster she is, Connie Willis. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
once a sailor loved me, but he was not a sailor who sailed on the wide blue sea. He sailed in an airship, sailed like a bird on the wing, and every evening at midnight he would come to my window and sing, come take a trip in my airship, come sail away to the stars, we'll travel to Venus, we'll sail away to Mars. No one will see while we're kissing, no one will know as we swoon, so come take a trip in my airship and we'll visit the man in the moon.
Doing a 1911 Boston Irish tune. Rick Bowes tells me this is a Boston Irish tune, and I think, oh, come on, Rick, is there anything you don't know? And turns out, well, no, there isn't. It is indeed. He was absolutely right about that. Named the year and all that. I looked it up. But that version, and I found a recording, about a 1917 recording, which, you know, unfortunately, the quality just isn't that good, so I ain't gonna play it. And also, that Natalie Merchant version is just entrancing. I love it. I love it. And I do love playing music, but I don't have lots of time. The show has been, I won't say truncated, but every week, Since the last thon is over, I have felt a little bit of pressure. Daniel Jose Older was on the first week that the thon was done, and we only got to play a little of his music, and he had to keep one of his short stories truncated, which was too bad. But then the next week we had Norman Spinrad on, and now he would have read a story, but okay, so this wasn't the timing fault, actually. This was the fact that he was sick and called in. But like a trooper, he did the show. And I just don't let people read over the phone. It's just not good. One person called up and angrily said, "Come on, read the story, man." And I'm sorry. And in fact, this is all an apology. I'm sorry. But first of all, I don't care for doing phone interviews, although people will have noticed I've been doing more and more of them of late, and we'll be doing another one next week. But I draw the line at people reading fiction over the phone. How long can you bear to listen to somebody read a full short story, which is what we feature on this program, full short story over the phone? It just don't work. So there was that. Then last week, when our guest was Harlan Ellison, that's where we came into a time crunch. I really had the choice between the second part of the interview or playing one of my favorite short story readings of all time is him performing "I'm Looking for Kadak." And I've actually gotten a number of requests from that from listeners of late. People are always, it's one of the most often requested things that we've ever had in 40 years of Hour of the Wolf, and for good reason. But we just didn't have the time to do both. But the day will come. And this week, the interview with Connie Willis runs about 48 minutes, but we don't have any readings of hers at all that I'm aware of. Nobody does. So if that changes, I will let you know. But she and I have discussed this, and doesn't seem too likely, so we'll have to give that a pass. By the way, if you missed last week, Genevieve Valentine, who is a wonderful reader and excellent writer, has also been doing movie reviews for this program, and I've also been trying to share it with other Pacifica stations and affiliates, did a review of David Cronenberg's Cosmopolis. And for no reason at all, other than I started last week's show with that, this time I'm going to end this week's show with that so that people listening at the other end of the time spectrum for the show will get a chance to hear that review. But because we don't have a reading, because the interview is 48 minutes, we have a little bit of breathing space, so it's time to play a tiny bit of music. I heartily, heartily apologize to those people who haven't gotten enough fiction on this show in this three-week period. I promise you we will do more to correct that, because I've always felt that the people who tune in Hour of the Wolf, that the primary motive for tuning in and listening, yes, it's to hear the science fiction and fantasy writers that you love or don't know about and want to learn about, or just hear a voice that you're not familiar with or a concept that you're not familiar with. But it's also just that people want the time-honored tradition of tell me a story. And when we're not broadcasting fiction, we're not fulfilling that. But changes will come, I have a little doubt, with any luck for the better. But who knows? These are dark, dark times at Pacifica Radio. And we shall see what happens. But Pacifica Radio or not, one way you can hear at least two writers read excellent, excellent stories, he said, segueing into a promo, It has been a long, hot summer, but we are returning with the 22nd season of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which is a series that I produce. And normally we go the first Tuesday of every month, but not this year. This year we're going to do the second Tuesday, because the first Tuesday would be, well, practically part of Labor Day weekend. And also the World Science Fiction Convention happens generally over Labor Day weekend. So I just wanted to give breathing space. So we're going to go the second Tuesday, which is September 11th. This is a total coincidence. Pay no heed to the fact that the date is 9/11. Even though one of our two readers is author of what I consider to be the best 9/11 short story piece of fiction I have ever read. And that's Richard Bowes, who, among other things, wrote the story that I'm referring to, There's a Hole in the City. Our two readers are Rick Bowes and Carlos Hernandez. Carlos was on this program, I think it was about 3 years ago. Delia Sherman was promoting her anthology, Interfictions, and he was in that. I was not familiar with his work, but she brought him along, and he was just wonderful. So he's going to be making what I believe is his, if not his New York reading debut, his New York science fiction reading debut. And a good way to describe him, is the bio he sent me. Carlos Hernandez features his Cuban roots in his writing, except when he doesn't. You can find his fiction in places like Beware the Night, that's where, W-E-R-E, like werewolf, Beware the Night, You Don't Have a Clue, Interfictions 2, Interzone, Futurismic, and Fiction International. But if your karma is good, his work will find you. By day, Carlos is a CUNY professor of English. He is also lead writer for Merryweather, a computer role-playing game chronicling the Lewis and Clark expedition. Richard Bowes lives in Manhattan and has published 5 novels, 2 collections, and 60 stories. His mosaic novel, Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, will be published in 2013 by Leith Press. Leith Press. Leith will also reprint his Lambda-winning novel, Minions of the Moon, in late 2012. I think I should have put a hyphen somewhere in Lambda-winning novel. Recent and forthcoming appearances include the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, Icarus, Apex, Lightspeed, and the anthologies Million Writers Award after Wild, like an Oscar Wilde, Stories 2012, Bloody Fabulous, Ghosts, Recent Hauntings, now that's fiction, mind you, Handsome Devil, and Hauntings. So, that's Tuesday, September 11th. Doors open at 6:30. Admission is free. We do ask for donations at the door, but if you don't have the money, don't care. If you don't want to give the money, care, but come anyway. Show up. It takes place at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which has been our host now. This will be, I guess, our third season at the gallery, which is located at 138 Sullivan Street between Houston and Prince. And for more information, you want to read everything that I just read to you, you can visit ourwolf.com, OurWolf.com, and search for the thing on the reading series, and there'll be a link there. You can join the Facebook group, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and if you're on Facebook, as long as you're on Facebook, also join the Hour of the Wolf group. Why don't you? We can discuss the radio show and other things there if you feel like it. Oh, and I'm even starting to do a little bit more on Google+. Okay, enough of this. Let's get to the main event. Connie Willis. I don't know why when people start to name, you know, who are the great science fiction writers today and all that, she's not necessarily the first name out of many people's mouths. But if you say, how about Connie Willis? They say, well, of course, Connie is one of the great writers. She just is. She has, I don't know if she has won more awards or been nominated for more awards than Michael Swanwick. The two are pretty much neck and neck. But just to name what she has won, not even, you know, what she has been nominated for and the things that maybe should have been nominated and weren't and all that. Well, she had her first award was for a novelette called Firewatch, which is a time travel story. And we're going to be hearing a lot about that in a little while. Not about Firewatch, but about the novel that ties into that. The Last of the Winnebagoes, Doomsday Book, which is the first of her Oxford time travel trilogy. Even the Queen, a short story, Death on the Nile, that's her Agatha Christie type-ish thing, as you can tell from the title. The Soul Selects Her Own Society, Invasion and Repulsion, a chronological reinterpretation of two of Emily Dickinson's poems, A Wellesian Perspective, that's a short story. To Say Nothing of the Dog, the second in that Oxford, The Winds of Marble Arch, which is a novella, Inside Job, a novella, All Seated on the Ground, and then Blackout / All Clear. That's really one novel, but it was published in two parts. It's a very, very long novel, and that is the third of the time travel, the Oxford time travel trilogy. These are merely the things that she has won the Hugo Award for. We're not even naming all the nominations, although I gotta mention her book remake is one of my favorites. Nebula Awards, almost as many, largely goes along with what she won the Hugo Awards for, Locus Awards. Basically, I should mention, by the way, that the Hugo Awards are basically a popularity award given out by anybody who joins the World Science Fiction Convention. Whether or not you attend is another question, but if you join the con, you can vote on the Hugo. And the Nebula Award is a peer award. It is given out by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, or SEFWA. And I have been, well, I opened the interview. You're going to hear the interview, by the way, unedited, uncut, as it happened. But with Connie, that's really not a problem. But I just wanted to give you a little bit of her background. And I have just been going through a major reread of a lot of her work, particularly that time travel series that I love of her so much. The first one, the Doomsday Book, has a certain amount of humor in it, but basically the premise of these books is that between approximately years 2040 and 2060 something, Oxford University is sending historians back in time to, if not critical moments, to avoid paradoxes, to at least eras and places at which they can see things. For example, in the Doomsday Book, it's the plague. It's the year of the plague. And the Doomsday Book, of course, was what William the Conqueror had created in order to figure out how to tax the English people, to survey all that, basically, he owned. And that's what the Doomsday Book was. But, of course, any pun you care to throw in there, when it involves the plague and then the fire, well, that, you know, says it all. And the book itself is not really a tragedy. Our lead characters, somehow they manage to make it out all right, but nevertheless they are witnesses to the plague, and characters who we care about succumb to the plague. Not our characters from the future visiting the past, but of course the past that they see, the past that were the people that were killed in the plague itself. And it's an amazingly well-written book with both comedy and yet is somehow, well, a little bit devastating. And I'm a shallow person. I don't necessarily like to be devastated unless it's worthwhile. Let me tell you, the Doomsday book is worthwhile. So let's segue from that to the second book in the series, To Say Nothing of the Dog. Okay, if somebody is really familiar with their travelogue stuff, you know the book Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome, and the subtitle of that is To Say Nothing of the Dog. This is a very, very Victorian novel, and it is a romp is the right word for it. It is hilarious. Any and all Victorian comedic stereotypes, cliches, tropes, that's the real word, tropes that can be met are. And just so amazing that she somehow manages to follow the Doomsday book with this wonderful comedic romp. And then comes the third book, Blackout / All Clear. As far as she was concerned, and we're going to discuss that, it was one book. But it's a long, long, long book. Those people who criticize the book say it's too long. I say it's not. I do have to admit that when I began reading it and when I was nearly done with Blackout, I wonder, why am I spending so much time with the minutia of life of these people? But when you start reading the second half of the novel, All Clear, well, it becomes all clear. It pays off. It pays off with time travel, the tropes, jigsaw puzzle, Agatha Christie-like moments that just match and fit together for a grand, grand finale, which you think, you know what, I want to reread this whole thing from the beginning and now take note of, oh my God, the character who was named thus in this novel becomes that person in that century, in that story, and this one is related to that one in this manner, and so on and so forth. And if I were to say anything more, it would simply become, to quote the great philosopher Riversong, spoilers, not going there. With that in mind, let us now hear that interview, because it runs 48 minutes and I've used 28 already of the 90-minute show. So let me start to tell you that this was held on the Friday of the Nebula Award weekend, which was near the end of May. And great thanks go to Jame Gates. That's J-A-Y-M. She is the PR director of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America and was helping coordinate the interviews. I had asked who wanted to be interviewed, and we got 42 responses, and Jame helped coordinate a lot of these into a combined effort that made it far, far saner than it would have been otherwise. And further thanks go to Todd Vandermark, who filmed this particular interview. Don't know what's happened to that, and conducted a number on his own and gave a great deal of technical help and advice as well as moral support. So, with thanks to Jame Gates and Todd Vandermark, and of course, the entity that is the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America, we take you to that day. Ah, I see it was the 18th. I actually marked it correctly. And here, unedited and uninterrupted, over WBAI in New York, here is a talk, not an interview, a chat with Connie Willis. So today is Friday, somewhere in 2012, at the Nebula Awards. Mm-hmm. And with me is Connie Willis. And I can never get... I think we've done about 4 hours of interviews between different conventions.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And the very first one was, in fact, at a Nebula. I think it was 2000.
you know, it's all just a giant blur.
I kidnapped you out of a hall. Yeah. You and then after that, Nancy Kress.
Uh-huh.
And it was wonderful. But this year, you are the Grandmaster.
I know. I'm so excited. I am excited.
It is about time.
Well, thank you. That's nice.
The body... Oh, I was going to start with something incendiary. Now I go complimenting you instead. And the body of work that you have created is just so wonderful. I pick up your books, even the pressing ones, like the Doomsday book.
I know.
And they're comfort food, even while they're provocative and thinking. I just know that I'm going to have a Marvy time.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very high praise. I appreciate that.
What should we talk about in terms of writing the what do you call the All Clear trilogy or Blackout?
Blackout and All Clear is one book. Which my publishers then cut in half because of length things, and I don't know what to call it because I had originally wanted to call it All Clear, and then have part one be Blackout and part two be Backs to the Wall. And that didn't happen. So now there's not a blanket name for it. So I don't know. I call it Blackout / All Clear.
But I was thinking of the whole time travel.
Oh, the whole time travel. I don't know what you call that. Those are my stories with the Oxford historians and Mr. Dunworthy and a Barry
Bells.
As a time travel emphasis on World War, a lot of emphasis on World War II. Just like I was reading the other day that Doctor Who, you know, why is he so interested in Earth? He has the entire universe to choose from, and he always picks on Earth. And I'm like, wow.
And he often picks on World War II.
It's like, but that's the most interesting thing in the universe.
Have you finally watched Doctor Who?
I love Doctor Who.
Okay. I mean, the last time I interviewed you, I had never seen
Doctor Who, and then. I had this horrible thing happen to me.
Just last October.
My daughter and I watched Sci-Fi's Alice, which was very, very good. And it's a reworking of Alice in Wonderland, a science fictional dystopic working of Wonderland, which I just loved.
And despite being on Sci-Fi, it was good.
Despite being on Sci-Fi, it was really, really good. Nick Welling is doing some interesting things on Sci-Fi.
Yeah.
And so we watched that, and Andrew Lee Potts played the part of Hatter, and we just fell in love with him. And so we tried to find out what else he'd been in, and he'd been in Primeval, this British TV show about dinosaur hunters in modern day London, which sounds like the dumbest premise ever, and which lasted about 6 episodes as Terra Nova in the United States, and rightly so. Terra Nova was just terrible. But Primeval is a wonderful show, and it's all about they use the dinosaurs to sucker you in, and then they get you involved in the character stories. And everyone kept saying, well, if you love Primeval, you'll love Doctor Who. So I finally started watching Doctor Who. I'm not terribly far into the new ones, but far enough to know that, yes, in fact, I do.
Where did you start with the Christopher Eccleston?
Not the old.
Because on the new Who.
Right.
We're already on to the third
Doctor.
No,
I know. And I'm way behind because I'm still doing DVDs. Doctor Who does many of the same really cool things. Primeval, I find more involving simply because you've got ongoing characters that you can become completely immersed in. Whereas with Doctor Who, you're limited in that permanent cast of characters. I mean, there's him and the companion, and then there's...
But he changes all the time.
I know, and I love all that. But I'm just saying that the Primeval thing I adore too. So now I'm a total Primeval addict and a Sherlock addict and it's not that I hadn't watched British TV before, but this has taken it to a new level. I think the new Sherlock is just brilliant. Just brilliant.
Same writer as Doctor Who.
I know. There is so much great stuff out there. And the thing I like the best is the Brits seem to have no compunction about doing old-fashioned stories with old-fashioned plot and character, and they're not trying to be edgy all the time, and as a result they the old stuff works the best. The old stuff always works. And I was just watching a YouTube video with Kurt Vonnegut, and he was talking about plotting, their little YouTube vignettes about plotting, and one of them he's talking about, okay, here's a story, okay, man falls into a hole. Man tries to get out of the hole. Man finally succeeds in getting out of the hole. People love this story. And I went, well, that's ridiculous. And then I went, oh, my God, Slumdog Millionaire. That's the plot of Slumdog Millionaire. And then I was like, and, of course, the plot of Oliver Twist. And the plot
I'll take
of,
that one. I didn't like the, Slumdog Millionaire.
And the plot of, gosh, The King's Speech. And the plot of pretty much everything. And I was like, he's so right. He's so right. And it's a very old-fashioned plot. And one that you know, people... A lot of times, literary writers sort of disdain the old-fashioned plots. There's a reason why they work. There's a reason why we love them. And I think that we see these as our stories, and we see these as stories that we love to tell ourselves. And so, you know, they always work. And so that's one of the things that really impresses me with British television and British movies is that they have figured this out, whereas Americans are still trying to do something new and edgy, and they're constantly doing romantic comedies in which the characters do not get together at the end. I'm sorry, that disqualifies you as a romantic comedy. And they keep trying to introduce, things really don't always work out. True. But we can get that at home. We want cool stories that we can follow and get intensely involved. And one of the nicest things about watching Primeval was that we watched the first three seasons on DVD. And then we had to wait until season four came out on BBC. I bought BBC America. I upgraded my cable just so I could watch Primeval, and then had to last from week to week, you know, as I waited for the new episode for seasons four and five. And of course, there was a huge break between four and five and the cliffhanger of all time. And I got back. It was like being a kid again. I got back all of that, you know, joy that you had when you couldn't wait to find out what happened to Frodo and Sam, or you couldn't wait to find out what happened to Cinderella, and you were just so intensely involved, and you thought about it all the time, and you worried about it all the time. And I was like, you know, that is what I think a lot of writers lose sight of as they get older and more accomplished. They start thinking about messing with other things, and they forget about how important that what happens next is in a story.
Yeah, I know. And I've had problems with some very popular American material, some of it by one of my favorite writers, in which they kill off the lead character in the first...
Yeah, right.
And I love this writer.
Right.
But...
Yes, and I think that...
And I explained to people that, A, I don't need the gore. B, I'll not necessarily watch the sex. And C, yes, I would like there to be some kind of denouement where I go to bed not dreaming about a beheading.
Right. Well, or not, you know, I feel like you can have almost any kind of ending. But the more I write, the more I realize something I didn't realize when I was a younger writer, is that there is always this contract that you and the reader have made, and you basically set the terms of the contract, but since you don't know what you're doing frequently, you don't then pay off on the contract the way you should. And I feel like, you know, understanding the nature of that contract, because sometimes the nature of the contract is I promise you that you will find out what happened, who committed the murder, or I promise you that these two characters will finally get together if you just stick it out long enough. Mm-hmm. I promise you that, and you're making these promises all the time, and you know, I promise you that like King Lear is one of my favorite things of all time, and part of it is because although it ends as sadly as any of Shakespeare's tragedies could possibly end, it isn't a horrible ending, because the horrible ending would be if he and Cordelia had never seen each other again, and they had never told each other they were sorry, and they had never forgiven each other and wept in each other's arms and made it all up. That would be a terrible ending, and one that would keep you up nights and make you not ever want to read Shakespeare again.
Yeah.
But he promised us that this lack of communication between them would finally be solved. And it is, at an incredible price, and you're leave the theater weeping, but still feeling pretty good because, you know, because the best you can hope is that you can forgive the people you love and you can be forgiven by the people you love. And I think Shakespeare is somebody who never, ever lost sight of what that contract was between him and his audience. And so I think about that all the time now. It's like, what am I promising here? Am I delivering on this promise? And you can set it so when the beheading comes at the end, that is absolutely where your readers, if even if they didn't think you were going there, where they feel completely satisfied with that ending. But it's all in the setting up, and you're holding.
Yeah, not in the book I was.
And
thinking
you're holding all the cards. But I mean, I mean, you can have any ending if it's properly set up. But I think that's what people don't always get.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was this book that I read. This woman goes back in time, finds herself in the plague era, and you know, the little everybody dies, the bells are ringing,
everybody
the
dies.
Little girl dies, and I was sitting there on the edge of my mental seat going, that baby isn't going to die. The baby died.
It was the plague.
I know. And but when, and she gets back to the present, a wiser person and the sadder but wiser, yeah, to an extent, and some comedy then begins to ensue. But it is, and even though this did not have
a classic,
the contract
happy
that
ending.
I, the classic happy ending that I thought that particular writer had put into the Doomsday books currently in print from
1985, I think.
Yeah, I was wondering, the publisher.
Bantam.
Bantam Books, okay. They always like it when you mention the publisher but and say currently in print.
And on Kindle.
I was still pleased with it. But then, to say nothing of the dog, is, I know this is probably not you thinking that this is your greatest work or anything,
but I
just love that book.
I'm pretty fond of it, and I think
he gushed.
One of my things is that the happy ending is really sadly underestimated, and that people, you know, it got a bad name back in the Victorian era, where they were going to cram a happy ending on, no matter which direction the story was going, and how unlikely it was.
And they would Baudelaireize.
Yes, and yeah, they even stuck a happy ending on Lear. And so I didn't, you know, but I think that the happy ending is, it's almost harder to write than the sad ending. Any high school senior can write a sad ending to a story.
Any high school senior will.
And does.
Yes, exactly.
It usually involves vomiting and suicide at some point. But to write a happy ending that doesn't feel contrived, that feels natural, that you are rooting for this happy ending, I think that's difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
And in To Say Nothing of the Dog, I have to say that it was partly motivated by the fact that the body count was so heavy in the plague. And I felt I was giving an unbalanced view of history, because history isn't all tragedies and horrible things. History is, for most of history, most of the people are having a pretty good time. You know, they fall in love, they have kids, they have happy moments, they breathe the fresh air, they look at the sky. You know, they're not always involved in wars and plagues and disasters, but those are the more interesting things to write about. And so then I thought, you know, if I'm really going to write about history, I really want to show the flip side. I want to show the funny side of history, and the times when, you know, instead of people dying and making tragic self-sacrifices and all these things, that there are also times when they're having jumble sales and being irritated by annoying people and having seances and trying to do things and falling in love with the wrong girl and falling in love with the right girl and all those things. And to me, that's as much a part of history as anything else. So I'm very, very proud of To Say Nothing of the Dog. And as you have pointed out before, Jerome K. Jerome is one of my all-time favorite writers. And I think his accomplishment, which, you know, he wanted, when he wrote He wrote To Say Nothing of the Dog, which has been in print since 1889. Never out of print.
Three Men in a Boat.
Three Men in
the
a Boat.
The subtitle is To Say Nothing of the Dog.
That's right.
Listeners who are now looking for Jerome, hey, Jerome, To Say Nothing of the Dog.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's,
yeah, no, but
right.
No, everybody that's should also be getting a book called To Say Nothing of the Dog.
But that's by me.
Under
but
W.
That's by me.
Yes.
Yeah. And anyway, in Three Men in a Boat, a book I read because I read Have Space That Will Travel by Heinlein, and Heinlein and Kip Russell's father in Have Space That Will Travel is reading Three Men in a Boat and thus not paying attention to what Kip is saying. And so as soon as I finished Have Space That, I promptly went and found Three Men in a Boat and loved it and have read it dozens of times.
Well, it's one of the most wonderful travel
books hilarious.
Ever written.
It's hilarious. And it's a brilliant accomplishment because comedy tends to be local and topical. So I frequently am reading comic novels written in the 70s, which I don't even understand. I mean, because I don't get the references, you know, and the farther back in time you go, you read something that clearly was a very funny comment in 1952. I have no idea who these people are that they're talking about. So it can't be funny. To have written a book that was funny in 1889 and is still funny in 2012 is an astonishing accomplishment. And it also offers
a gateway to people who were not necessarily interested in things Victorian.
Exactly.
And it just pulls you right in
it
and
does.
Says, I got to get more of this.
And the sad thing about Jerome is that he wanted to be a serious Victorian novelist and felt that he was a failure because his most famous thing is this. And then he wrote a short story called The Passing of the Third Floor Back, which is also a great story. It's a science fiction story, but it is not, you know, it's not serious Victorian literature, according to their lights. And I'm thinking, you created this comic masterpiece, but because of the worldview of the Victorians, you didn't even recognize it when you did it. You know, that is really sad. And so I'm a huge, huge Jerome fan, and I wanted to do something of the same kind of book that would just show the fun side of life, because we don't focus on that enough. But to show the fun side of life, you know, and not kill anyone, and I was determined to kill no one. I was determined that everyone would get a happy ending, including all should be well, including the dog and the cat. And the cat really didn't deserve a happy ending, but I gave her one anyway.
Yes, yeah, I was astonished at that one. I thought, okay, we know who the fall guy is.
Yeah, I know, but see, I promised I'd give everyone a happy ending, and even cats, you know, cats have their own. They live in a different moral plane from us, and so you can't expect their behavior to match what we would like it to be. So I was very happy with that. And then, but then, as I say, all along with my time travel stuff, I have been trying really hard to do what I consider a complete picture of history. And so then when I wrote Blackout and All Clear, I was trying to finish the picture, which is half through, halfway between tragedy and comedy, and shows a more balanced picture of history the way it really is. It's, you know, people actually had fun during the Blitz, believe it or not. And people actually had personal tragedies that had nothing
right
to do
there,
with the
And right there, by the way, is one of the best Doctor
around.
Who episodes, but go on.
Exactly.
Yes.
Oh, I know. And so I just, you know, I feel like, you know, that's what I've sort of been aiming at, is to try to show myself what I think history is. A history not the history of, but history as a concept. What history is like, this big picture of human behavior. And I don't feel like there's anything I left out at this point, although, you know, 3 or 4 years down the road I might suddenly go, oh, I forgot to tell this part, and then want to do another time travel novel.
So. That would be good. With that same basic...
But I'm not going
to... But the Oxford people are fun.
Yeah, but I won't do it unless I have something else to say about history that I haven't already said. So.
Right.
Because I think it's important. These are books about history as a subject. And I got to read this wonderful book by J.R. Elton called The Something of History. And it was I bought it in Britain, and it's about the time that I wrote Firewatch, and it's the only book I've ever read that's about history, not the subject matter of history, but history as a concept, you know, what is history? What is its nature? If you look at the whole panorama of history, what does it look like? And that just is amazing to me, and part of what I've pathetically tried in my own small way to put in my books. So, mm-hmm. So the practice of history, that's what it's called. Practice of history.
I was just about to
J.R. Elton.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a good book.
So for the moment, you're done with history?
For the moment, I had to take a break. It took me 8 years to write Blackout All Clear. And
yeah, that was quite an accomplishment.
And it was a very long and difficult 8 years, and I was late for 6 of those 8 years and under a lot of stress, and convinced right up to the very last second that I had bitten off way more than I could chew and I wasn't going to be able to pull it off. So I'm happy now. So I'm doing a romantic comedy about telepathy.
Oh, yay.
I know. I'm so happy. I love romantic comedy. And I love the concept of telepathy because telepathy is like the worst idea anyone has ever had. The idea that, well, but we know what people are thinking. Exactly.
There's that Paul Anderson story. Was it Paul Anderson who wrote a story about two people that finally gained telepathy?
Yes, and it was awful.
And it was just like, now they know the secrets.
Exactly.
And now it's like you peed in the sink.
Exactly. Right. It's a horrible,
Journey's
horrible
End.
Thing.
Journey's
yes.
End by Paul
yes.
Anderson.
And there have been a lot of science fiction stories about telepathy. There's been quite a few movies about it. But they all show the truly, either the dark side, you know, I am stuck with a psychopath in my brain, or the, you know, the kind of, the CIA is after me because now they're going to use me to catch terrorists kind of plot. And I was like, I don't think anybody has ever really done a romantic comedy the way I want to do a romantic comedy, which stresses what a terrible idea telepathy actually is.
Mm-hmm.
So, and just, you know, it's not just the psychopaths in your brain, but the really boring people. I mean, I work at Starbucks all the time. You know, I love working over at Starbucks because you get to overhear all these great conversations. And people...
We should point out, when Connie says she works at Starbucks,
oh, I do
she
my
is
writing.
Not a barrister.
I would be. I think that'd be a great job.
Well, a different kind of barrister,
right.
Maybe.
But I actually take my writing over there and do my writing at Starbucks. And I'm there so much that I'm just a fixture.
It's all French roast. It's
I don't drink
wrong.
Coffee. I have ice grande chai.
Very good. Okay. In that case, it's all right.
Yes. And the New York Times. Thank God. It's the only place in Greeley you can get the New York Times. And so I have, but I'm there so much that nobody pays any attention to me. You know, I'm just a fixture. And therefore, people talk quite freely in front of me. And so I overhear all these great conversations.
Little do they know.
But there are occasional people who have these conversations, and I'm like, I am dying of boredom here. How can you stand yourselves? You are so boring. And so I'm thinking, you would also be stuck, you know, with like hedge fund managers in your brain and really shallow people in your brain and totally boring people in your brain. And how much fun would that be? Not fun. And so I thought that would be something fun to work on.
Yeah. So. My favorite works of yours are the romantic comedies.
I love romantic comedies.
Yeah, you know, it's I did an interview yesterday with John Kessel.
Uh-huh.
And my favorite book of his is Corrupting Dr. Nice,
right.
Which is like a little Preston Sturges,
right.
A little
John and
up
I are both
Howard
huge
Hawks.
Preston Sturges fans.
Yeah, okay,
so.
Three of us at
yes,
least.
Yes.
At least I haven't watched
yes.
Palm Beach Story in 2 days.
My favorite is the Lady Eve.
Yeah.
Well, or maybe your Miracle of Morgan's Creek, or possibly Hillel Hero.
You can't choose a one.
No,
my
one,
favorite one is the one that I'm watching at the moment.
Well, lately I've been watching the Lady Eve because I am one. The other thing I've been working on kind of sporadically is a nonfiction book about romantic comedy, what it is, how to write it.
Ooh.
Not a how-to, because I don't think how-tos work, but a book about what is the what's going on in a romantic comedy, and therefore, hopefully, you could write a better one because you now know what's going on. But it's a complicated dynamic, and of course, Sturges has it down cold. He's wonderful.
Yeah.
And he manages to be... See, to me, romantic comedy is like sonnets. Okay, it's a really rigid art form. You know, and you have to have 14 lines, and you have to have iambic pentameter, and you have to have a rhyme scheme. And within there, somehow, you have to be completely original and different. But you don't get original and different by scrapping the rhyme scheme or scrapping the 14 lines. You know, like, they're always, the reviewers are always going, a totally original romantic comedy in which the characters do not get together. And I'm like, that is not a romantic comedy.
You have to
stick to the rules, and then within the rules, you have to do something really original. And Sturgis...
I mean, if you do the Noel Coward thing, you can swap couples.
You can swap couples.
But they find each other
right.
at the end.
Somebody has to find somebody.
Yeah.
And it has to be an adult relationship, a relationship, not a seducer seducee relationship,
right?
An equal partnership relationship.
Yeah, it's not about the sex.
Right. Well, it is about the sex. It's a grown up relationship in that you're partners. You're working together against the world. You really know each other for what you are. I mean, it's really probably. My conclusion, which I did not expect to come to working on this book, is that romantic comedies are the one place that you find actual, really healthy human relationships between the sexes. Because, you know, obviously not in opera. No, not in opera.
Not in melodrama. I was going to say film noir.
Right. Not in film noir. Not really, hardly any place. Usually you're looking at bad dysfunction and irreconcilable differences and all that stuff. And in romantic comedy, you're actually looking at relationships
Ball of Fire.
Yeah, Ball of Fire. One of my favorite movies ever. And nobody's ever seen that movie. I love Barbara Stanwyck. She is so good.
I mean, she's doing Drum Boogie with Gene Krupa.
She is fabulous.
Oh, yeah.
Fabulous. And has so much emotional
I wish I knew how to roll the eyes. The roll of the eyes that they used in the era, which was a way of saying, do I know about sex?
It was an amazing
thing. And you find it in the melodramas and in the comedies.
You do, but in the melodrama, one of the problems with melodrama is it's a place where, and most drama, people...
Pre
and post code.
Okay.
People directly state what they're feeling. In real life, people never directly state what they're feeling, ever. And in romantic comedy, you never directly state, which is why people don't say, I love you in a romantic comedy. They say, here's looking at you, kid. They say, like in Harry Met Sally, I hate you. I really hate you. They say anything but what they're really feeling. And I think that's a very realistic, you know, portrayal of real life, too. And it makes it so much sexier, which is why you don't have the sex on screen, because the sex on screen has nothing to do with the code. It has everything to do with, this is all oblique. We're looking, this entire movie is in code, and we're figuring out the code.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you something. You're writing a lot of romantic comedy. You write some simply thrilling adventure stories, just fun stuff and stuff that isn't fun but is thrilling, is wonderful, it's engaging, it plays in my head.
Oh, good.
Perfectly.
Oh, goody.
So you know where the question is going. Where are the adaptations? Why am I not seeing you on the silver screen?
You know, Hollywood is a whole mystery wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a conundrum.
They run around looking for stuff. They don't find it.
Well,
and they couldn't do better than by reading Connie Willis and hopefully paying her tons of money.
I will say, you know, that...
Do you get options?
Yeah.
Does your stuff get options?
Yeah, it's just that, you know, it's Hollywood. Who knows what's going on? It's like trying to figure something really bizarre out. I don't waste any time on that. I will say, though, that a lot of my stuff is, when you look at it, I do try to do things that you cannot put onto the screen.
Yeah, I mean, remake could never...
Right.
Well, at this time, could never be imagined visually on the screen.
And
Bellwether could, like that.
Bellwether could. But you would lose Sandra's voice. And a lot of my stuff is, a lot of my comedy is voice stuff, which the movies have never figured out how to master voice, which is why there's never been a movie of Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
There's never really been a correct movie of Lolita. Because they're voice novels. They're unreliable narrators. And so, you know,
Kubrick never really does the book. He just adapts.
I know. And I mean, I think there's some good screen adaptations of Lolita, which, by the way, is one of my favorite books of all time. But But I think that they'll never make a really good movie of it because it's all in Humbert's head, and he's lying. He's lying with every breath he takes.
Yeah.
And so you can't, there's no way to get that on the screen. When you put something on the screen, even if you have wavery images at the edge, it takes on a solidity that makes it real, and then it makes it very hard to say, nope, that wasn't real at all. I made that up. You know, and I think...
Yeah, and, you know, I wasn't even thinking about it, but when I was thinking of Bellwether, I was imagining the circumstances, but I had forgotten,
right.
Yes, it's all about her voice.
It's all about her voice.
It's because
yeah.
She's the most important thing
yeah.
in there, but I'm not learning it secondhand. I see her...
Right.
But maybe it's
you see
the
her,
male...
But, yeah,
it's the,
right.
The male thing.
Right.
I'm not being her.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, it's hard to do, and I do that on purpose, because I feel like books can't compete with movies by just trying to be exactly like them. Books have to do what they do better than movies do.
Yeah,
and movies
I
have to do
books,
what they do better than books do.
Yeah.
And the best way to succeed is to really do something that you can't translate. And in Blackout and All Clear, several people have said, oh, that'd be just perfect. I'm like, okay, so what are you going to do with the people that are actually not who you think they are? Because the minute you see them on screen... That blows that.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with that?
I have
you know,
the answer.
Until you think of it, then you can't put that on the screen.
I don't put it on the screen, but I do have the answer.
Which is?
Radio drama.
Radio drama, maybe.
Yes!
Maybe.
you know my proclivities.
But then
sir.
You lose all those great visuals of the Blitz, which the Blitz is all about.
No,
visuals.
You don't lose them at all. Yeah, you do the right sound effects. You do the
well,
right.
Well, that's true.
You do no.
But I'm
no.
thinking of those.
We have better special
I'm
effects
of those
than.
Sound, I'm thinking of the sandbags. I'm thinking of the helmets, the tin helmets. I'm thinking
yeah.
of the tube. You know, those are great visuals.
They are. They really are.
So.
And that's a lot of what sticks
but,
with you. The whole Battle of Britain kind of visualization. Yeah.
yeah. And I'm and but I you know as far as the movies go, it's something I just. I could never survive in Hollywood. I love Hollywood. I love movies. I love how movies are put together. I want absolute control over everything that I do. And there is no control in Hollywood. And so
no.
I just do what I do, and we'll see what they do.
You know, a couple of things have changed in the last 10 years with... a woman who kept utter control to the point where initially they were being derisive of
right.
her. But J.K. Rowling did
yeah.
okay in terms of controlling her vision. Whether or not you liked the movies resulting, she controlled the vision largely. That was a very weird...
Right, but see, I don't think I should have any control. I don't know anything about the movies. I know nothing about making movies except what I, you know,
no, but
I
they
watch sh-
they show
I
it
like.
To you and they
so,
say thumbs up or thumbs down,
right,
Connie. That's
right.
Well, that's.
But I'm like, you know, this is, you know, I do what I do. I love books. I've always loved books. I have, you know, it's like,
yeah,
that's what I want to do.
Yeah, but.
And I'm fast running out of time, so I obviously have no time to learn a whole new career.
So, no, that's true. I can understand that. It's just that. I look forward to seeing... There aren't really good romantic comedies on screen today. There really aren't. There
That's
are
true.
Okay,
okay. The Abby and Connor story in Primeval. Spider-Man 1 and 2 actually has an excellent romantic comedy embedded in it. Yes, it does.
It
meets all my rules.
Uses the form.
British Wimbledon. Love Actually.
Oh, do me a favor, the table.
Oh, sorry.
This is very sensitive for the mics.
Wimbledon, Love Actually, a lot of the British. Notting Hill, About a Boy.
Notting Hill I liked.
Yep.
About
yep.
a Boy I liked.
They do. They know what they're doing over there.
The Hugh Grant movies. The Englishman
Who
Went Up a
the
Hill.
The English Hugh Grant movies, not the American Hugh Grant movies.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And they actually know how to write romantic comedy over there, and they do a very good job of it. I think there's a lot of good stuff. And, in fact, one of the reasons I got so hooked on Primeval was I could not believe that I was watching an ongoing romantic comedy in a dinosaur hunter adventure series, and that I kept being convinced that they were going to screw it up. And they didn't screw it up. I was like, you people actually know what you're doing. I am so impressed.
Well, I remember the last time... we spoke, which was last October of 2011, you had not yet gotten on your Doctor Who kick. And you have not yet gotten, I take it, to the point where Matt Smith is the Doctor,
no.
Right?
I'm just
okay.
Getting it.
When you start with that one season, let me tell you, as an arc, as a thing, it starts with a conundrum, it ends in a wedding. Everything that happens in, and it's a wonderful, wonderful, crazy wedding with time slippage and everything.
Oh, good.
That season as a whole, that 13 episodes that Stephen Moffat wrote, is a brilliant romantic comedy.
Oh, good.
I think that will be your favorite season. I'll be interested the next time we meet to find out about that.
Okay.
Also, by the way, as long as I want to get back to writing, talking about Connie Wills, but I also just wanted to mention, if you like that, you might also like a British TV series called Coupling.
Oh, I've heard about that.
Which
yes.
is also by the same writer, again, Stephen Moffat.
Right, right.
And Jekyll.
Okay. Okay, sounds great. Thank you. I'm always looking for new good stuff to write.
With Jekyll, you can end at episode 4, but it's only 6 episodes long. But,
Well, and I do think
there's the romantic comedy.
I will say,
in
defense of the American series, they have a true disadvantage here in the States, which is that they have wrapped their season ender before they know if they're going to be renewed or not. Over there, they find out they're going to not be renewed, and then they have an opportunity to wrap up their stories, sometimes in a good way, sometimes not. But at least they have an opportunity. There's nothing more frustrating than to end a series, you know, with a horrible cliffhanger and no resolution to the stories. And that's what happened to Primeval. It did 3 seasons and then got canceled. And then they had to scrabble around for extra money. And when they got the seasons 4 and 5 funded, they were determined, even if it meant that they would not get further funding, they were determined to bring all of these relationships to a resolution.
Bring closure.
And bring closure, which I... So, to me, they put the fans ahead of their own, you know, financial situation. And that was so brilliant, because there would be nothing more frustrating than to leave these people forever in limbo. And one of the things that impressed me the most, I'm sorry, I love Primeval, and I've just been rambling about it for 2 years.
It's funny, because
I just love it.
I haven't gotten into it.
I know people. I know people who watch it and go, what is it you like about this series? But
I know what my friends say. Blonde.
Hannah is great. Abby is great. But that one of the things they did was at the end of season 3, which could have been the end of the series, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They left romantic comedy couple, in a situation, incredible cliffhanger, the kind that keeps you up nights. And yet, at the same time they were doing this great cliffhanger, they also had complete closure for that part of their relationship. It was one of the best scenes I've ever seen. I'm like, I don't know how you did that. I have never been able to do that, where I both did the cliffhanger and the closure at the same time. But that's really good. And that was when I became just incredibly impressed with what these people were able to do.
But cliffhangers aren't the kind of thing that you tend to write.
I have cliffhangers in every chapter. I hope I have cliffhangers in every chapter.
Okay, fine, yes. But there's a problem.
Right, but there's no closure.
I read the next chapter immediately.
I'm not
putting it down and saying, I'm turning those pages, Connie.
Exactly, and that's one of the things about a book, is that, you know, you start racing through because you don't, you know, you can't put it down, but I was very interested in the whole dynamic of how the fact that I wasn't able to read, you know, the next chapter instantly when I was watching Primeval, how that provided some space for me to really think about possibilities and do my own, like, evolving of the story. It's like, I wonder how I can duplicate that in my own work. That would be really cool.
That would be interesting. But here's...
But I have no idea.
But here's the other thing, is that we're all so far, another way that a lot of your best work can never have a cliffhanger is because a lot of your best work is the short form.
True.
That's okay. True. And you don't get cliffhangers.
That's true.
In a short story.
Although you have to leave them in the middle. They're in the middle, but they're
yes,
not at the
absolutely.
End, right?
But it's not a cliffhanger.
Right. Right.
The closure occurs if nowhere else occurs in your head.
Yes.
You get a feeling of completeness, and if you want to carry it on afterward, you're perfectly capable
right.
of doing that on
yeah.
your own
and
with what
right.
you have provided.
Exactly. But I'm always so fascinated by people who will say, you know, why didn't you write a sequel to Bellwether? Or why didn't you write a sequel to this or that? And I'm like, what? I just told you the complete story. There is nothing else. If you want to carry on the story in your head, fine.
But you know what you're doing when you do that. You know, you're fostering fanfic.
Well, that's all right. I don't care. Fanfic's a whole different thing, and I understand the impulse completely. Totally.
But you were saying earlier, that you want to be in control of the whole thing.
No, I'm in control.
And here you are.
I am. I'm in control of the whole story. And then if other people want to embroider on that, I don't care. But I'm at least
control
of the part I want to be in control of. And I always want, you know, I think one of the problems with sequels and stuff is frequently, you know, I want the story always to be about the most important incident in this character's life. This is the biggest moment they're going to have. And it can be a finding of a relationship, or it can be passing a moral test, failing a moral test, whatever. But that moment is their big moment. So then if I write sequels, any sequel that follows is going to be, by definition, their second biggest moment, or they're not quite as big a moment, etc. And so you're constantly losing tension, you know. So that's why I've never written sequels, and
yeah.
I've never written series. I've always just written, I want the story to be the complete story, and you better believe that this is the most important thing that's ever going to happen to this character, and you get to watch it. And so that's why, you know, and it can come at any point in their life. That's what I love about short stories, is that you can, when I wrote All About Emily, which is my story about
yeah.
a robot who wants to be a Rockette, you know, we've got this actress who's facing one dilemma, which is she's about to be overcome by the aging actress syndrome, you know, and she's losing the power and the glory that she had as a big star. And then she finds herself faced with a moral dilemma that, you know, where her own interests are going to be at direct odds with what she needs really to do. And that's nothing more interesting is ever going to happen to her. Even though she's clearly had many, many big moments, how she broke in, how she became a star, how she shone on stage, any of those things, nothing. This is it. This is the big moment. And
yeah, you're not writing slice of life. You're taking
this is it.
That.
And I'm always worried, because the thing is, as I get older and I read the news all the time, I realize that you can have a really exemplary life where you've really like passed all the tests and then blow it at the last moment, you know, and you can become Joe Paterno. I'm just like, how terrible is that? You know, you kind of like think, okay, I passed this test, and I've passed this test and this test, and I'm okay. And then you realize that you could hit your big moral moment any second and blow it big time.
Mm-hmm.
And he blew it. There's no, you know, and how awful is that, to blow it in the last 30 seconds of the game?
Yeah,
I mean, that
right.
is terrible.
That's happened to some presidents with cigars.
Yes,
it's
happened many, many times to many people. And I just find that the most frightening thing. Because,
wow.
you know, it's like, well, crud. Now I have to make sure I get out of here without blowing it. How depressing is that?
But that could be a wonderful comedy.
It could be.
If
it
you write
be.
The character
Actually, Jessamine West, I believe, has written that story.
Has she?
Yes. She wrote one of her Amish stories. You know, she did Friendly Persuasion and
right.
all those.
Right.
Not Amish, they're Quakers, sorry.
Okay.
She wrote a number of, actually, Friendly Persuasion is not a novel, it's actually interconnected short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then after Friendly Persuasion, she continued to write about those. Yeah. She continued to write about those characters. And she did do a sort of last minute moral decision story. So I think she beat me to the punch.
Okay.
So.
But actually, there's an example of somebody who, in essence, returned to the world did sequels.
Yeah. Well, she did, but she was always doing... I love Jessamyn West. She was always doing really fascinating stuff. She never covered the same territory in any of her stories, even though she had the same characters in the same world, but she never covered the same...
Well, sequels, when they're done properly, shouldn't be covering
the same territory.
Right, exactly. I mean, I have no interest in Men in Black 3.
Right, but too many... Oh, I don't know. See, I'll do anything to see Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. I mean, it's just like, oh, good! Oh, this summer's not going to be a dead loss after all. Excellent. And I'm happy to basically see those two read the phone book as well.
Well, so, okay. No, I'm not saying I won't see it. I'm just saying it's Men in Black 2 was Men in Black 1, even
with
in the
romance.
Sets, practically.
With
romance.
With romance.
Except they got rid of Linda Fiorentino. It's like...
Well, they didn't. No, they didn't. Well, or for maybe for 3 they did, but...
Oh, no, she's certainly not in 3, but anyway, too many movies... That have a two on them.
Too many movies with a two on them are a complete
Are just
disaster.
Rewrites of
yes,
one.
Yes, they are. They are.
And they They're not sequels.
That's right.
They're rewrites.
I think when you write, one of the things you have to ask yourself is, why am I writing this? What is the point? It's not even, what do I have to say here? I don't like the whole, somebody told me early on, if you don't have anything to say, you need to get out of the field. And I was like, I don't have anything to say. I have all kinds of questions, and I would like to examine these questions. That's not the same as having some... If you have something to say, you write an op-ed piece, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or one of those kind of crazy letters to the editor. To me, literature is too big to be about blanket statements. You need to be writing things about... that you don't know the answers to when you start, anyway. And maybe you won't know the answer when you get to the end, but you're raising all these really interesting questions. But I think if you can't answer the question of yourself, why do I need to write this? What is it I haven't explored before that I'm exploring now? Then you shouldn't be writing it, because then you're probably just repeating yourself in what you've previously done.
Well, we have only a couple of minutes left.
Okie dokie.
For this round.
I know, I always talk too much. I apologize.
No, oh, God, no. I could go for another 3 hours. We recorded 3 hours
at Cap Clave,
and I could have done more.
I know.
That broadcast, by the way, the listeners, the response to that.
Good.
And even though we sat in the middle of the con suite.
Right. That's
it,
great.
I was getting phone calls. I was just sitting there smirking, saying, boy, is that a good broadcast. And the one we're doing right now is another one as well.
Good. Oh, goody.
And if you want some time during the weekend or whatever, we'll just...
Okay.
You know,
all right.
We'll do this. But the sequel to this interview... we'll have a few cliffhangers and a few questions. How was your reaction to one thing or another? And when do you think we might see this new novel?
Well, it's supposed to be turned in February of 2014.
Oh, my God. I can't wait that
long. I'm really slow.
What stories do you have for
I'm writing a story about paper dolls. I'm writing a story about a mysterious bookshop. I love mysterious bookshop stories.
I love mysterious bookshop stories.
I'm writing a story about the Isle of Capri. I'm writing lots of stuff.
Okay.
So, lots of short stories.
Have you been researching by going to the Isle of Capri?
No.
This traveling at all?
No. That to be continued.
Okay.
Okay.
So, again, thank you so much, and congratulations.
Thank you.
For being the Grand Master.
I'm really excited.
So are we.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Connie Willis, conducted at the Nebula Award weekend, held and given out by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America on May 18th at 1 p.m., my notes say here. And again, her name is Connie Willis, W-I-L-L-I-S. Where do you start? Start with her collection of short stories. She has more than one, but there is one, and I actually have to look this up now. There's a best
of, or rather a compendium of Connie Willis stories. And if you look that up online, you will find it. I think The Winds of Marble Arch, which is also the name of a novella, is the over... Oh, I just passed it by. And yes, I was right. The Winds of Marble Arch and Other Stories, a Connie Willis compendium. And as far as novels are concerned, my personal favorite is Start with the Doomsday Book. Don't let the tragedy of it bother you. Move right on to Say Nothing of the Dog, and then be prepared for the grand finale in Blackout / All Clear, which was published as two books, but as you heard Connie say, is actually one. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. For more information, conversation on this kind of stuff, you can visit the website, ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. Vastly in need of a makeover, but slowly happening, podcasts slowly happening. The Facebook group is up and running. You can go to Facebook and look up Hour of the Wolf. And if you want to read about the movie, well, go to the movie. It's an excellent film by Ingmar Bergman. But if you want to know about the, you know, the other one that says group, that would be about this radio show. And you can do that and find out more about my reading series there as well. Or, just, you know, I don't want to say friend me on Facebook because there's actually a limit to that. I don't have a fan page. I'm not that egotistical enough. But therefore, I'm also limited in the number of people I can friend. And I'm actually sort of approaching that limit. Okay, alrighty. Dare I? Let's see what this person has to say. I dare briefly. Good morning, you're on the radio. Nope. Well, I dared, but they didn't, so I'm not going to take that dare. Instead, I'm going to follow through on one promise that I made. Last week, we premiered a new review by Genevieve Valentine, herself Nebula Award-nominated novelist, Genevieve Valentine, and I've been encouraging her to do reviews of independent films for this radio show and other spots on WBAI and through Pacifica Radio. And we broadcast this one last week, but the movie opened last Friday, and I see no reason not to rebroadcast that review. Whoops. Right now. If I get it queued up properly. There we are.
Reviewing for WBAI. Tell me what you mean, or don't. Halfway through David Cronenberg's new film Cosmopolis, one character demands this of Robert Pattinson. She doesn't get satisfaction. Neither will you, but that doesn't mean it's not worth sitting through. Robert Pattinson plays Eric Packer, a billionaire financier who, at the movie's start, decides he needs a haircut. As his limo goes crosstown in the sort of agonizingly slow traffic that seems less surreal the more time you've spent in New York City, the film unfolds in a surrealist series of one-act plays as he runs into his wife, takes a series of meetings with coworkers outlining the freefall his finances are in, and watches the streets outside get more dangerous. There's more plot than that, but barely, and it's a thing the film's not concerned with. Though there are a few recurring characters, with the scenes largely disjointed and very much contained in the limo, Robert Pattinson's performance sinks or swims with his scene partners. In some cases, it works out marvelously. Samantha Morton, as Chief of Strategy, is amazing, and Paul Giamatti appears in the film's third act and is himself, which tells you pretty much everything you need to know. Some scenes, you're just going to have to sit through. It's not a subtle film. It begins with an epigraph about rats as units of currency, which turns out to be less a motif than it is fair warning. But at the same time, it's a film genuinely concerned with ideas, which overcomes a lot of the stagey blocking and leaves you thinking. tell me what you mean or don't. But there's enough to think about that I, at least, will be back in the theater. This is Genevieve Valentine, reviewing for WBAI. You can also visit me online at GenevieveValentine.com.
Whoops, okay, no, I had that set up for segue, but didn't want to start it quite yet. I still have, 90 seconds to go before we actually sail with our sails of silver. But let me add, yes, visit Genevieve Valentine at GenevieveValentine.com, and also if you care to send her email, do it through me, jim@ourwolf.com. Say, for Genevieve Valentine, I will not read it, I will merely forward it. And let's see, what else? Oh, God, next week. Well, it hasn't been enough to have the forthcoming great Daniel Jose Olderon, followed by Norman Spinrad, followed by Harlan Ellison, followed by Connie Willis. Next week, another one of the absolute, utter, all-time greats in science fiction, I kid you not, will be our guest on the phone, live, so we can take phone calls and stuff, Michael Bishop. I've never interviewed Michael Bishop. I've hardly met him. We've met in passing at ReaderCon and a couple of other places. He is just, well, look him up. That's your homework assignment, is to go to Wikipedia or Google or whatever and look up the name Michael Bishop. He is another person who's written wonderful comedy and tragedy and all kinds of brilliant science fiction through the years. He is one of my favorite writers, and I am oh so looking forward to it. So, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Back next week with Michael Bishop at 1:30 a.m. Eastern Time in New York, and whatever time it may be, wherever on the internet or in the world you may be listening, or, well, you might be listening to us at archive.wbai.org. One way or the other, keep listening, keep thinking good thoughts about us, click your heels, turn Wittershins, whatever it takes, and stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister, coming your way to these airwaves imminently. Good morning, and take good care. And then once again, thank you, Connie Willis. You are a treasure.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
This is your WBAI Community Bulletin Board with announcements of upcoming events. I'm Earth Mom.
And I'm Derek Gibbs.
On Thursday, August 23rd, the Meles Cinema's Summer of Music Harlem Outdoor Music and Screening Series presents Sing Your Song, a film about the life of singer, actor, and activist Harry Belafonte. The screening takes place at the Jackie Robinson Park Bandshell, located at 148th Street and Bradhurst. The program begins at 7:30 with DJ Layla, and the film will be introduced at 8:30 by producer and daughter of Harry Belafonte, Gina Belafonte, and director Suzanne Rostock. For more information, go to MaylesInstitute.org. That's Mayles, M-A-Y-L-E-S, Institute.org.
On Tuesday, August 28th, there will be a special WBAI fundraiser at the Edgar Cayce Center in Manhattan. Jack Rosen will share knowledge about the Edgar Cayce Remedies, a collection of natural, easy-to-make holistic remedies for many health and well-being issues from arthritis to colds. Everyone who attends will receive a copy of the Jack Rosen interview with Earth Mom. For more information and the cost of this fundraiser, go to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2869.
Theater for the New City's award-winning Street Theater presents its annual summer tour with the musical Political Comedy, 99% Reduced Fat, or You Can Bank on Us. Performances are on Saturdays and Sundays at 2 p.m. in parks and outdoor venues throughout the five boroughs. 99% Reduced Fat will be at Brooklyn Sunset Park at 44th Street and 6th Avenue this Saturday, August 25th, and in Jackson Heights, Queens at Travers Park at 34th Avenue and 77th Street on Sunday, August 26th.
And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the best. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
Thank you. I'm not on a slave ship. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I toss you the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Find yourself living in misery.